listening to Creative Friction, a podcast for ambitious creatives and agency owners that are looking for honest insights on how to scale their business sustainably and profitably. Each episode, we dig into candid conversations about the most pressing topics in our industry and offer up insights and resources to inspire you to take action.
From talking about the latest and greatest in AI to unpacking how our industry can better represent and reflect our modern world, we're here to guide you on agency growth, marketing strategies, and how to make a meaningful impact as a creative entrepreneur.
All right. Hello, and welcome back to Creative Friction, a podcast for creative entrepreneurs navigating the challenges of growing a business while staying true to their creative roots.
Each episode is recorded live, so guests can join and ask questions that matter to them and their business.
I'm Madeline Reeves.
And I'm Jeff Mead, and today we're here to talk about the importance of market research as a key way to understand your customers with Ryan Gibson.
Ryan Paul Gibson is a marketing leader, father, and husband who holds an amazing claim to fame that he has interviewed more than 1,800 people in his career. With over 20 years of working with brands from small startups to major enterprises, Ryan makes his mark on the world through working with marketing teams to help them understand the behaviors, motivations, and psychology of their core customers. Ryan brings his passion for customer research, go-to-market strategy, business development, and brand storytelling to life through Content Lift, a boutique agency that leads curated customer interview processes to help companies understand and truly align with their target markets. We're really thrilled to have you here, Ryan, and I can't wait to learn more about your approach to market research. So let's get into it.
Ah, thank you. That was great. I don't know if like it's, you said it's like amazing that I've interviewed 800 people. I don't know if I ever feel it's amazing, but I appreciate that.
I feel that's a lot more than I've done. I don't know about you, Jeff, but enough. That's a lot more than I've done.
Some of the things, maybe I'm just crazy and I'm like ADHD hyper-focused. That's all I want to do. But thank you. Very nice introduction. It was very nice.
Yeah. Ryan, it's great to have you on the show. Just looking over your bio, and I'm sure our audience, and we want to know more. Your career path has been really interesting, right? Like you started in marketing, then you went on the reporting media side. Now you've come back to marketing. So could you kind of explain how that all worked?
Well, that'll probably take the whole hour, but I'll give you the convinced version. Yeah, I started off in B2B, but I started off in selling franchises. So restaurant franchises. I'm up in Canada, and it was a chain of coffee shops, similar to like Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay.
And my job was to sell the businesses, the turnkey businesses to franchisees. And it was great. I was very lucky. I was early on in my career is way in over my head. I made a ton of mistakes. But what the part I owned the most and the part I liked the most was marketing. And that's where the research actually started, because for anyone who's not familiar with consumer markets, because we would sell restaurants that served consumer markets, research is like the gold standard. Like they know their customers more than almost any other type of industry, right? The consumer product. So I used to go in and do all that work myself because it was a big chunk of my budget. It would have been a big chunk. So I did it myself, and I do everything like people on the street interviews. I would do surveys. I would go into competitors and I would start chatting people up in lines, pretending I was a customer and ask them why they bought here. And people thought I was insane, but it was great. And that influenced all my marketing and all my business development and all the operations. And the reason I left is my early 30s, and I was just like, I don't know if I would do this anymore. So I went back to school, took broadcasting, and I thought I was going to end up in the business side of media. And I just, through a whole sequence of events, I found myself being a TV and radio reporter at CBC in Ottawa, which is, we call it the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, be similar to NPR, BBC, in the UK. Right. I did that for 3 years. And that was really where I learned my investigative interviewing chops. And then that just wasn't my calling after a few years, just for a whole bunch of reasons. And I was like, maybe I'll go back to marketing. I really liked it. But I also do something different than what I was doing. And that's when I started working with entrepreneurs, early stage startups, run marketing teams for software companies. And now in the last 4 years, I've been on my own and I focused solely on customer research. And we'll probably get into that a bit.
Absolutely.
But that's like always where my passion has been, understanding customers, why they do what they do, how do we give them what they need so they can improve their lives.
So in that whole pathway, what What triggered you? Why did you become interested in becoming an entrepreneur?
Yeah. I think like most entrepreneurs, you always sort of have the bug. Mm-hmm. It's always there. You know, when it starts to become a reality is like a different story.
Right.
I post about this. Like I have a laundry list of failed ideas.
And I think we all do.
Yeah. And I think I got to the point after I ran marketing, you know, I was getting later on in my career, I'd worked for people for my whole career. I was like, I think I really now want to do it for me and control my time. That's, mm-hmm. I think, the biggest part. The money was never really the thing for me. It still isn't. It's like, how much control over my day do I have? And that's really my sort of guiding light. I just never really found a fit before. And then the reason I was working with a few clients, and the pattern I had seen was a lack of research to really inform their go-to-market strategies, how they build products and services and so on, right? Mm-hmm. And or just the lack of how to do it very well. So I was like, I wonder if this is going to be the thing. Can this be the thing? There's no way this can be the thing. So then I just used my own approach to validate whether this could be the thing. And I got enough feedback from the market to say, I think this is the thing. So I looked in the landscape, saw who competitors were, looked at, I think this is how I can position my strengths based on the feedback. And where I started 2.5 years ago to where I am now has evolved, right? But I got enough data from the market to say, okay, I think there's a path forward here. And I've been going ever since. And it's my best decision I ever made.
Wonderful.
I want to turn our direction towards that conversation about research, because it's the heart of what you do. And I think you probably saw in your data that a lot of folks were getting it wrong. I've seen in my experience that everybody thinks that, the way that you get important information is you're just going to send a survey, right? It's this quantitative process. Answer these five sets of, you know, questions, check these boxes, and we'll have the insights we need. And you have a really different approach that's got a lot more nuance and a lot more qualitative conversations that you're having with customers of these companies. And it's been fun because you and I have collaborated here and there on projects. So I've gotten insight into your process. But how do you position that to companies, Ryan, who think that, I just got to send another user survey?
Yeah. So there's a lot to that. I'll try and keep it as concise as I can.
Yeah.
I think the short answer is, if you're selling to another business or another person, you know, how they make decisions about solutions is not something that they consider in a day. Like, they don't wake up and buy something. No one wakes up and buys a thing. Even with commodity products, right? If we're talking coffee or a pair of running shoes, we don't just wake up and decide who we choose. There is a gradual affinity we develop for solutions over time. So your job, in my opinion, is as either an entrepreneur, founder, what have you, is to understand how your ideal or best fit customer progress through those stages of affinity, or how they move towards your solution. What is the information they're looking for? How do they, you know, they build preference for you? What is that process they went through? What convinced them? That's not something you're going to learn in a survey, right? You'll learn very basic binary questions, yes or no, numbers. But why did those things happen? Why are those the data points you're getting in your survey? What motivated them? What pushed them? What triggered them? Why did they choose you over something else? That's what you get at with qualitative research, but, you know, talking with customers in a specific way that you won't get. And that informs everything you do from a marketing and sales strategy, and often a retention strategy, right? And you can make better choices. You have more informed data to make better choices about where to, you know, throw the dart in your business. Does that answer the question?
Totally. Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to jump in and just remind the audience, please, if you have any questions for Ryan, just write it in the comments so we can shoot it to him. Absolutely. Ryan, I think it's really interesting, because when I think about just the clients I've worked with, or even my clients, their clients, which are usually larger companies, they are so fixated on surveys, right? Because they want to know that, I guess for the most part, when they get the information back, they want to have 98% confidence that this is the way we should go, right? Like, they throw all those those terms around. So how do you convince them, or what's really to sell, that qualitative should be in the mix? How do you get into that conversation?
Well, part of it is what I just talked about. You know, that's one of the best ways to understand that more holistic journey that can happen over weeks, months, sometimes years, right? Of how people build affinity for solutions or products or services. Mm-hmm. The second is you need to understand what the best way to manage your time and your money in your business. Like, where a business is a bet in a market, right? And you need to de-risk the odds you're going to lose that bet. So I often will structure it around capital, cash flow, mm-hmm. you know, the ability to generate new revenue, right? How do you know which, there's only so much time and money that you have, especially if you're an entrepreneur with a small team or you're by yourself. How do you know where to put your time that's limited? And then specifically to the survey side of things. Yeah, I get that question because some people think that quantitative is more statistically relevant. But the reality is, if you do the work right from a qualitative standpoint, it can be just as statistically relevant. It's just like anything, you need a formula and a process where you're not creating an environment where you're creating bias, right? You have rigor in your process. But you have to put all those elements into the research from a qualitative standpoint to then get things that are statistically relevant. There's a whole academic field on qualitative research that's existed for decades, right? And they've been able to prove out that the findings they get from certain processes and approaches are pretty bang on. Mm-hmm. And I know that from my own work too. So yeah, that's, but I tend to say surveys are great. Don't get me wrong. Fantastic. You need to understand some quantitative elements to your business. We've been using quantitative numbers in the business world for decades. Totally fine. But that going back to that qualitative side of that subjective journey that people have, how do you create objectivity around it so you know where to invest your resources and time? And that's sort of how I like to phrase the conversation.
And so say I'm the client, right? And I'm like, okay, I'm willing to give it a try, right? Like it's a challenge because a lot of people wait to have these kind of conversations, I feel like, until it's almost too late. There's a lot of entrepreneurs, there's a lot of companies that fall in love with their idea or their product and are just like, it's going to hit. It's going to, you know, people are going to go for it and are not even willing to do some validation up front. But say a company's kind of like, okay, this is worth the time. This is worth the investment. We're not landing in the way that we thought. How do you then go about designing a customer interview process for that brand? And you know, feel free to come up with a mock scenario because obviously every brand is different, right?
Yeah. And there's two different parts to your question. There's before you launch, mm-hmm. do I have something that's valid? Or, okay, I have some traction. Am I targeting the right people, mm-hmm. right? The before stage is really about understanding the pains and problems people have to achieve a certain outcome. Right. So most people do not buy solutions, product services for what they do. They buy them for the outcome that they can achieve. Or one of the really classic ways we think about this now in product and service development is called jobs to be done. Mm-hmm. I won't get into it too much. There's a lot out there. But if you Google it, it's really just understanding that process from how did they identify and prioritize to solve a problem? Why did they choose the solution they did? And what is the progress that that solution allowed them to make? So just to break that down, like some of the classic examples they give are, you know, people don't buy drills to hang a picture. Or sorry, they don't buy drills to drill a hole. They buy drills to hang a picture and build a house, right? If we want to take a marketing view of it, we don't buy HubSpot because we think that's marketing. We buy HubSpot because maybe we want to have better data around who our audience list is, and then we can segment and send them customized messaging, right? Because that frees up my time from doing X, mm-hmm. right? So there's all these reasons why people want to buy things to progress. So your job at the validation standpoint is to understand, okay, if they're here with a problem and they want to end here with a solution, what are all the pains in between, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So your job is to understand all those pains, map them out and figure out, okay, which one of those one or many do I want to solve a solution, whatever that solution might be.
When you have revenue, it's and then you have to understand, okay, I might have a smorgasbord of different customers. So my objective is to understand, okay, who's the best fit? Mm-hmm. Or you're going back to, okay, they all share these pains somewhat. Who has the most pain? Who's finding the best? Who's finding the most progress in what I want to do? I'm not sure if I'm directly answering your question, but that's how I start to think about these things. I have an objective in mind about what I want to understand. And I go and I try to prove or disprove that hypothesis.
And what one of the things that I think is most challenging is then if you're a brand that hasn't necessarily had open lines of communication with their customers in the past, how do you get people to say yes to even talking to you? Like, how do you get customers, what's in it for them, right? Because I think that's the challenging thing. And we know this, if you've done surveys, you're lucky to get a response rate of 10%. But to get somebody to sit down and have those kind of conversations, what does that take? And I also think, like, here for me, what can companies be doing to open up those lines of communications with their with their customers? Because I think a lot of people are not creating space for that feedback to just come through organically.
Yeah. So a few lines of thought there. The first is often we are having conversations, but sometimes it's just, it's client management or customer management, right? So we're asking like, how do you like the things? The thing going well? We're doing a good job. And we don't do a lot of that deep discovery conversation around like, why did you come here in the first place? Mm-hmm. Tell me more about your business model. Mm-hmm. You know, like those types of things. That's the best place to start if you're having, you have access to those people already. If you don't, then you want to find some of your power users, some of your clients that, you know, have been around for a long time. Maybe if you want to understand like the impact you've had on their business, if you want to understand more about how you to market to them better, maybe some that just closed, right? You can speak to them. Getting them to talk to you, how I always, everyone's always busy, right? Getting people to talk to you is actually a very challenging scenario. Most people are busy. Most people are, you're not their priority. They have many other things in their lives they're trying to get done. They still, and that's if even if they still want to help you, like they might actually be open to having a conversation for 30 to 40 minutes about the depths of their business and how you've helped them. But they might just not have a lot of time. So how I like to structure it is, listen, it's not a sales conversation. We're not going to be pitching you. We just want to understand more about how we've helped you, your business, you know, how you solve problems, how we've maybe helped you. And you can incentivize them if you need to. I do that a lot of my work more than ever before, which is offering them either some type of gift card donation. Charitable donation works really well sometimes for people because most companies have some charity of choice. A lot of people really like that. Sometimes a free gift, right? If you have a relationship with this client, you probably have some information on things they like. Send them something, right? As a thank you, either before or after. So those are some of the ways, but it's really, I think the language is about making it about them, how you want to learn more about their business. That's going to form how we can help them better. And really keep it like a casual, informal conversation. And that should come when you're reaching out and contacting, that vibe should resonate.
You know, listening to you, I'm reminded of, and it feels like a lifetime ago, but once upon a time, I used to moderate focus groups, right?
And oh, fun.
I didn't know that, Jeff. Yeah. Oh my gosh. What a
fun fact.
What a way to spend your days, my friend.
Yeah. It was exhausting. I mean, tiring, but I'm sure as you know, Ryan, it's so fun to just be in a room with so many people getting so many different perspectives.
Absolutely.
And so when I think about qualitative, automatically I go back to focus groups because that's what I used to do. But what are you doing now? Like when people think qualitative, I think they just think qualitative focus groups. Are there new things popping up or are you doing just one-on-one interviews?
Yeah.
What are people asking for? And better yet, what are you recommending to get that insight?
It depends, right? Which is like the common answer and the worst answer. But so because qualitative research is vast. You touched on one focus groups. I do one of my specialty is one-on-one interviews. Mm-hmm. There's actually moderated versus unmoderated interviews. So moderated interviews is what like a focus group is moderated, but it's just a one-on-one interview. Unmoderated interviews is me actually maybe going through a website and I'm recording myself answering questions about the website or a product or a service, right? That sort of thing exists. There is now, there's software you can use out there. There's a few companies where people will type long form answers in to different parts of your product or your website or your messaging. So it's not like a, it's sort of like a hybrid of survey and qualitative, but I might write a whole paragraph about this was my thought on your website. And first is my impression of your messaging. And it didn't land for me here because of this. It's like very deep. Those, I think it all depends on a few things. One is time. How much time do you want to take to do the research and draw out insights? I'm a big fan of what they're starting to call agile research, which is how do you do quick sprints to get specific insights, then test in the business so you can learn faster. Big fan of that because some researchers will tell you, oh, it takes at least 4 to 6 months to get deep insights. Maybe the challenge for most businesses, that's almost 2 quarters and a lot of happens in a market in 2 quarters, right? Maybe the whole thing has changed.
Yeah.
Now we've seen a lot of that in the last 4 years where there's constant shifting. Mm-hmm. I mean, AI wasn't even really around to the extent it was 2 months ago. Yeah. Now it's everywhere. Yeah. How has that impacted your business? So I like agile research. And then it's a matter of cost because for you to pay me to do the work for you is a lot more expensive than you say, doing unmoderated interviews, like I just said, where maybe you send people 5 questions and you record them answering these 5 questions and they get sent back to you. There's software, a piece of software to do that. Both are great, but there's pros and cons to both and limitations to each, right? So it's really just understanding like the time you have, the depth of insights you want, because I will go deeper on one-on-one interviews than someone who's going to answer 5 questions on a recording. And what's your budget? So those are like most things. Those are sort of the trade-offs. I hope that answered the question, Jeff.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. And when you say quick, what is quick? Because we think 4 to 6 months for research. People always think research takes forever. And what's a quick sprint?
For me, the fastest I've ever turned a full research project around is 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But that's due to a certain specific process and rigor of how I approach it, right? Mm-hmm. Especially because let's just take interviews. People will sometimes ask me like, how many people do I need to talk to? Mm-hmm. And there's actually a lot of data and debate around that. But if you want to get super nerdy about qualitative research, which I tend to at times, there's peer-reviewed studies that qualitative researchers have conducted over the best sample size for qualitative research. And the average consensus is that you can get away with talking to 7 people.
7?
What happens is there's a term called insight saturation that a lot of researchers will use in the qualitative sphere. And what that's just a fancy way of saying, when do I stop learning new things? What happens is if you plot all the new learnings on a bell curve, by the time you hit 7, the bell curve starts to tip. You're going to get probably hit 95% insight saturation, 95% of all learnings by the time you get to 15. So it's really like managing your time. So that's why I say to some companies where, okay, we just want to know this one thing. Let's be very specific about who we talk to, what we talk about, the lines of questioning we're going to ask them. Let's talk to 7, see the insights that come back, and maybe we can action some things very quickly into the business.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I love is like that if you take that quick sprint approach, in theory, you could turn around and integrate that into your content, into the way you're presenting things on the site, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
But all of us here on this call know that this is where brands struggle most is, great, I got this insight, I got this reporting, I got this feedback. But then it's the matter of how do you spin that into your marketing, your content strategy, your brand narrative, et cetera. And so I'd love to just talk more about the ways in which brands can use this sort of research to transform their approach to marketing in an actionable way. Because I think we've all been a part of those scenarios where you bring in the data, but it doesn't really turn into anything from a content perspective because brands don't know what to do with it sometimes.
Yeah. So I can come at it a few ways, right? Because I work a lot with software companies, as you know, Madeline, like you and I have worked together on a few projects. I also work with a lot of high-end consultants at times, right? So they have like really high average contract values, sometimes as high as like $100,000 for one customer. So there's a few ways. Let me give you a few examples. Like one consultant I worked with was trying to build out an agency where they helped pharmaceutical companies launch digital healthcare products. The challenge was they weren't sure, like, where do they struggle, right? Like, where do they actually need help? So how we approached the research was, okay, well, let's map out all the stages of how a big pharmaceutical company creates, ideates, develops, and launches a digital healthcare product. And then we can figure out, like, where they fall down in that process. So we figured out, okay, these parts they're okay with. These are the parts where they need help. And then, so to your question, now we knew what to lead with on the website, and we knew what to lead with in messaging. When he did networking calls, he would say, this is what I see companies most struggle with. Tell me about if this is where you struggle, right? So you start to choose where you pick and choose where you start to invest your time and your energy. Another example would be, I've worked for years with a company in Canada called Rewind. They're a software company. They do backup recovery software for platforms like Jira, like Shopify, QuickBooks. And what we did a research project after they did an acquisition, which was for GitHub. And to keep it short, what we found was persona we were marketing to really wasn't resonating with their messaging. And we couldn't figure out why, because we were using the intel that the founders had given us who had built this product that we acquired. So I got tapped to go and talk to some of the customers. And what we found was they were actually just trying to create their own version of Rewind on their own, because they're all developers and IT people and they had the skill set to do that. We'd heard that. We sort of knew that, but we didn't understand the extent of which they were trying to do that. And the problem, and what we found was 99% of the time they failed at it because there was a whole bunch of technical limitations that they couldn't build the product. So we were leading with back up your data, protect your data. We switched a lot of our ad campaigns and paid ad buys to stop building your own backup system, software, because that's what they were doing. And that led to a double of installs for the software product over the course of a month, right? So those are the ways I think of these things to, like, inform your marketing. How that'll work for each business is going to be different, but you'll find where people get stuck, the words they're using, we call it voice of the customer work. You know, what are the words that they use to describe the problem? They use to describe your product. The words they use to describe the outcome. And that gets infused into your marketing. And you become more credible. They start to see themselves in your marketing. And they build more affinity for you over time.
I've got to be honest. I hate big banks. I hate what they do with our money and all the insane fees they charge us for basically no reason. So when it came time to pick a business banking platform, I knew I needed to find one that actually cared about small businesses and aligned with my core values. That is why I chose Relay.
Relay is a no-fee online business banking and money management platform that helps small businesses take control of their cash flow and get crystal clear on what they're earning, spending, and saving. What most small businesses don't consider is how big of an impact money management can have on their day-to-day financial clarity. With Relay, business owners can bank with no account or overdraft fees with no minimum balance required. Issue up to 50 virtual or physical Visa debit cards, send payments and deposits via ACH and wire, integrate banking with accounting software like QuickBooks Online and Xero, and so much more.
As the CEO of a small business, I love how dedicated Relay is to helping small business owners like me understand exactly how much they're earning, spending, and saving, and consider them one of the keys to helping Fearless Foundry grow and manage our money with ease. You can check out Relay by visiting creativefriction.com/relay and apply for an account in less than 10 minutes.
I know where you're going, Madeline.
So yeah, you know what I'm going to ask you about because you teed me up perfectly.
Okay.
Customer personas. So I you brought it up. We got to talk about it. I have a process. I'm sure we all have a process. And I have a huge bone to pick with people that just build them out of thin air. And or anything that's like ideal client avatar. And I'm just going to pick demographic attributes based off of what I've got in my head. And I'm going to make a little picture. I believe that it's like, I'll even go so far as to say when people do it in that way, I find it to be very dehumanizing and very disconnected with an understanding of
disconnected is a good word. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'd love for you to talk about your approach to persona development and why, because I feel like this is something so many companies miss the mark on, and it drives me crazy, right? Because I'll be in an initial strategy moment with somebody and they'll be like, no, no, we've got our personas. And they'll come to the table with this stuff that they've just pulled out of the woodwork, as opposed to having any landing in reality, any connection to the customer. So will you talk about this a little bit? And Jeff, chime in too, because I know you care about this as well.
Yeah, very much a debated topic in my career over the last 20 years, right? I think first, I always like to think of like where they came from. And I think people need to keep in mind that they came from the consumer environment where, like personas, where they informed advertising channels based on like things like Nielsen ratings, right? That's the historical path of personas. And it made sense at the time because my path to the market was these types of channels where I knew X number of people were watching, you know, some sitcom at Friday night, right? And I would mark them Super Bowl, very good example of how to use those types of things to inform personas. But that's different than understanding why people would buy the thing in the first place. When we get back to quantitative versus quality. I think personas are just a victim of like garbage in, garbage out at most points. If the data you put into it is very high level, it's there's not a lot of depth to it. It's subjective. It's not going to give you a lot of the really good insights you need to then where do you throw the dart in marketing and what do you do and why? So I mentioned just a few minutes ago, something called voice of the customer work. And a lot of researchers will lean into that. Copywriters lean into that type of work. Content people will lean into that, that type of work. And that's really just capturing in the customer's words why they do what they do. So my personas are probably a little different than people typically see over accounting Anne and engineering Ellen, whatever, right?
Right.
What I will have is often like these people's roles and responsibilities within their company or their what they do in their life and their some of their interests. I work in mostly B2B, so it's usually, you know, what they do, what their responsibilities are, what they're on the hook for, how they measure success in their role, how they measure success in the company. And then some firmographics, right? Company size, team size, so on, right? Because that stuff still is somewhat important.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really care about more is their pains and anxieties. So pains I look at as what are their challenges and blockers to getting all those responsibilities they're on the hook for done. Anxieties or fears around them not getting them done or fears they have about maybe not hitting the mark. I care about triggers, right? So business triggers and how we define those often in, say, the jobs be done world, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, or just the business development is what are, if there are specific catalysts that took place that drove them to action? And whether that action is just to casually look for a product or to actually go and talk to a salesperson about, hey, I saw your thing. I want to buy this. Are there things that, you know, innate, like specifically happened that we can pinpoint. And then I care about how they research, which I equate to marketing. Like, what is the process of them, you know, going through solutions, finding ways to solve problems? One of the things people need to remember to keep in mind is we often don't compare apples to apples when it comes to solutions. We compare approaches. Mm-hmm. So I said HubSpot earlier. I might use HubSpot or I might use Google Sheets. Mm-hmm. To keep track of my lists of customers. Both are acceptable approaches. Why would I choose either of those, right? And maybe I did look at each of those. So I want to know the research process, who I talked to, what was I looking for? I'll ask people in interviews. So when you went to the website, what did you think was a lie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. What is a red flag for you in marketing? What is the information we didn't have that you needed? Things like that. Mm-hmm. Then I'll have them, they'll evaluate, I'll ask them about their sales process, their evaluation process from when they have a short list of options. So you have two options, you've whittled it down. Now what happens? And they walk me through that. And then we get outcomes, business outcomes. All of that, what I just said in the last few minutes is in my persona.
Mm-hmm.
That's much different than what you often typically see. And it's very, there is like an executive summary version. And then there's like an in-depth version. With like clips from people talking, audio snippets, real life examples, like it's very in depth. Now, you could say, well, that's a bit overkill. Maybe. But if you don't deeply understand your market and your ideal best fit customer, then your chances of winning are so low. So you need mm-hmm. that depth of research. Doesn't mean you're going to ingest it all right away and get it all right immediately. That never happens. But my clients, when I talk to them, because I interview my own clients 3 to 6 months after we've done the work, because I want to mm-hmm. see like the impact. And they'll say, I always go back. I learn something new each time, or remember something, or before I make a decision about something that I think might be impactful, I go and I revisit the research mm-hmm. to make sure I'm on the right path. So that's to me, that is where personas should be. So, you know, so I get the beef, right? Because I share the beef. How I try to rephrase it for people is you just need better information in that.
Yeah. What you described, I don't usually see. I usually see the engineer and LN, or it's really pulled out of thin air. So I definitely commend you.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like I once spoke to someone. They ran an agency. Oh, well, they're a boutique agency, digital agency. And we're just having a chat, right? Just getting to know each other businesses. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a client they had. They said, yeah, we did personas for them. Oh, great. Like, tell me about these personas. Where'd you get the information? Oh, I just went into Google Analytics and I pulled all the data from the website. And that was the persona. I'm like, oh my God. And they were spending money based on. And I was just like,
yeah. I'm glad you said that, because that's actually where I was going to go. I see people do that a lot, right? Instead of building a persona, it's actually really looking at who your customers are and then just modeling after that. And so now, when people do that, what do you say to that?
I say, that's great for targeting. Great. You might, now you know, maybe you'll know like where to maybe deliver ads. But what should be in the ad? Right. Mm. Let me give you one more example. I'll take it to maybe consumer version. I did a research project for a coffee shop chain here in Ottawa, Canada. Very small shop. They had about 9 to 10 restaurants. And it was good. It fit in with like my old career back in the day. So it felt really at home. And what they wanted to understand was, okay, were they having debates within the leadership team about why people chose them?
Mm-hmm.
So, half the leadership team thought they're choosing us because they want their coffee aficionados, they're experts in coffee. They want really high, really exquisite roasts and that type of coffee snob type mm-hmm. stuff, right? And the other half of the leadership team was like, no. They just don't want Starbucks, but they want a consistent cup of coffee and that sort of, they still want the corporate service without the corporate feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they were paralyzed about making decisions about what to do in the business. So like, Ryan, come break the tie. Like, okay. So when we interviewed their clients or their customers, it was really interesting, because when we talked to the coffee experts, they would say things like, I'm always in search for the perfect cup. You know, it's just the adventure of coffee. I'm always out there trying to find it. I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, that's churn.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a loyal customer. And then when I interviewed the people we identified as other regulars that fit maybe that non-Starbucks, and people were saying that actually in the interviews, they were saying, I just didn't want Starbucks anymore for whatever reason, right? They would say things such as, I found them and I finally found my home. I'm like, there's your customer right there.
Yeah.
So then what we did was we did some of that brand identity work, persona work, what they cared about. And their best fit customer was a working mother, 2 children, this type of salary, but cared about these things like outdoor activities, hiking, cycling, being involved in the community, cared about corporate responsibility, things of this nature. So guess what influenced their, we knew it in Google Analytics, how to mm-hmm. target them, but guess what influenced the ads? Mm-hmm. All those qualitative things I just talked about, right? So the ads are no longer a cup of coffee. The ads was a woman sitting in her chair or her house drinking her cup of coffee with the equator bag. She just pressed in her coffee press and she's like, I can finally start my day.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, so all those things about targeting and analytics, like that mm-hmm. stuff's helpful for delivering that ad copy, but you need to understand like what has to go into those ads and that messaging. You only get that by talking to people.
Yeah. And I think this is where a lot of smaller agencies struggle because they're in the business of creating the content as opposed to talking to customers as that first step. And you just shared having these conversations then unlocks other agencies' work, right? We can work on the brand identity. We can redo the ad campaign. We can redo the messaging and we can have it be successful. But, you know, I'm wondering if you have, you know, advice that you would pass on to agency owners, especially smaller ones who don't feel like they have the capacity or maybe their clients don't have the budgets to do this kind of research. Because small shops, I think, need to focus more on bringing this into their wheelhouse because, like we're saying, it informs the success of all these other things that come after. But I think that a lot of us, myself included, sometimes jump in and say, okay, well, let's just start working on execution, the new site, the new ads, whatever it is, rather than figuring out how can we have this data to be informing the deliverables we're creating.
So the question is like how me as a limited resources, how can I try and do this work?
Yeah. And a lot of our audience is, you know, smaller agency owners, you know, maybe they have a team or maybe they've got a contractor model, but they're oftentimes like, I don't know how to sell this or integrate this into the work that I'm doing.
Yeah. It is tough with agencies. When I was doing my own due diligence around this work, I talked to a few agency people who had done B2B historically, and they said trying to sell research was super hard. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's great. I'm so excited to try and start this as a business now. But I knew there was a way, anything, it's all about conversation, how you frame things, right? So I try to do now with partners, because I actually work with a lot of partners. I'm starting to work with more and more agencies, demand agencies, fractional CMOs, because they understand the value of the work, because it's sort of, it sets the stage for everything. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of it is if it's a question of buy-in from the client, which I get, then I think it's, again, going back to what I said earlier, where you're trying to communicate, okay, this sets you up for success or your best chance for success. This is going to be a better way to spend your money over the long term, right? Depending on their business model, if you're working with a sales team, you can say, I want to increase the chances that you get in the best fit prospects to work with and see, have a higher chance of closing. If you're working with an executive, it's, I want to make sure you're spending the company's capital effectively, right? Because there's only all the money in a business is from one pot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we all debate where it should go. I mean, you worked in house before, Madeline. Like your money is coming from the money that everyone else has to get within the company. You have to debate about who gets the biggest lion's share. And then for marketers, I always say, we want to maximize the chances of your success. Right. And then if we continue to get friction, what I often do is I'll show to, like, you know, if we have examples of where you've worked with our clients, where you've done work where research is informed the activities, that's the best way. I talked about Rewind. If you go to my site, contentlift.io, I have one case study. I call it my one case study. And it's a bit of a riff on, like, sales teams always want another case study, which I get. I understand why they want.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of tongue in cheek, but I walk through my entire process and I show the results that I talked about with Rewind. Because what I try to do is show other marketers and other entrepreneurs and founders, this is the net result, this type of work, the depth of it, right? So that's like the pushback side. If the challenge is like access to customers, because sometimes that's the challenge too. We talked a bit about, okay, how do you do the messaging? You might only need to talk to 7. If it's just a content messaging, you could probably get away with 5, right? If it's not like a deep dive into the DNA of the business, even 5 conversations with customers could work, right? Or what I use more and more in my work now are paid panels. So we talked a bit about like different options for qualitative research just a few minutes mm-hmm. ago. There's companies like User Interviews, Respondent.io. And what you can do is in these communities is you type in a list of firmographics and some qualitative type qualifiers. I want someone who works in this industry and they have this experience and they've done these things. And you can incentivize them to talk to you for what, $75 for an hour? I think we're up to $500 an hour based on their experience and their title and their role in the company, right? So the more experienced you are and the more specialized you are, the higher the price. But what they're acting as is a consultant about how they buy things and what is their view of the market. Now, they aren't your customer, but they give you a lens into people who are like your customer and your ideal buyer. It gives you a lens into what they like, what they prefer, how they make decisions. So those are some ways that we can do that. And you can sort of build that into your price structure, right, as part of your own. So if I have to run 5 interviews and it's going to cost me $250, that's $1,250 US, you can actually just build that in, right, into a package, and no one will ever be the wiser, right? Because you're going to say, and part of this is some research we're going to conduct on your behalf, or you can just say part of this is the development of the creative, right? So that's one way it sort of hides it. It's a little sneaky, but it's one way to get around it, right?
Yeah. And even the way you packaged it, right? Like when you first started out and said, you know, you talked to between 5 and 7 people, I think anyone listening is probably mind blown in some ways, right? Because you always think the number has to be so high, right? Like back in the days, I felt like the number I heard was like 30. So you always feel like the number has to be really high. So the fact that you can talk to 5 or 7 people and be confident in that direction is really helpful.
Jeff, there's a caveat to that, right? Which is you have to be very specific with your research, right? And who you're talking to and why. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't talk to, one of the examples I give to people is I wouldn't talk to a chief technical officer at a startup and an IT manager at a hospital and ask them the same line of questions, because they've totally different business models. They're doing different things. There'll be some overlap, but those are different personas.
Right.
So you have to be very specific in how you do this research. But you're right. Historically, I've heard as high as like 50. I've heard as high as 100.
Right.
But if I talk to 100 people at an hour each, even half an hour each, say it's half an hour, that's 50 hours of audio, if I've recorded everything, that I got to go through again. Right.
Oh,
and and I always record everything, because you are not going to remember everything someone says in a one-on-one interview. You think you're going to take good notes. I guarantee you, your brain is your enemy there. Because you're so many things you're juggling in your mind at once as you're conducting this interview. I record everything and go back.
Yeah. You're giving me flashbacks to when I used to listen to my focus groups.
Yeah. Like, how often did you retain everything that was said? Probably very little, right?
Very little. You just have to, you know, listen to the recordings, and then each group is like 90 minutes, 2 hours. And
but yeah, I always advise people 5 to 7 people to start, as long as your parameters around your research are very tight.
Mm-hmm. That's really, I think that's going to be a huge takeaway for people, because that small amount, that small sample size is just, and especially if you start saying at 75 per person, then you can really go somewhere with it. I see this comment from Frank. I guess the question is some good AI tools that are in the space.
Feels like more of a statement.
Yeah.
But I get it. Yeah. I mean, there are ones that aggregate insights from recorded meetings. I know Fathom is one of them. I don't endorse them in any way, but I've seen them and I think what they do is fine. How I'm trying to explore AI in my work, and I've seen other researchers more on the product side do this. So product researchers, UI, UX researchers, they'll take qualitative interviews. They'll cut it up and throw it into some type of ChatGPT thing, and it spits out aggregation, because I do it all sort of myself manually. So I'm interested in seeing that and seeing how effective that is. But the challenge with the AI stuff is you lose nuance, right? Mm-hmm. So I always advise people, nothing wrong with aggregating insights, but you still should go back. Yeah, statement. Thanks, Frank. You should always go back and re-listen, because there could be really specific nuggets of wisdom or really powerful insights. I've conducted interviews. I've seen a statement by a customer that I thought, this is incredible. And we've tested that in ads that day just to see, because the hunch was, you know, we got towards the end of the research. I'd seen it enough. This one was like a banger. And I'm just like,
let's test this. I want to see this in an ad. And you can spin that up in 5 minutes if you have Canva. So that's the power of this work for me, is how quickly you can test things if you really start to deeply understand your customer. But Frank's right. There are some really interesting ways you can probably leverage AI now to help with this work.
Mm-hmm. But I think that we're going to see a huge uptick in this in the next year or so, which I appreciate, because it then makes this more accessible, right? It makes it more accessible to folks who are running smaller shops to integrate in. And I love that strategy that you offered, Ryan, of don't give the client the option. Instead, just bake it into your process and say, the first step that we do is to validate, or is to talk to, you know, the customer, so that we're on the right track by the time we get to the creation of this kind of content.
I've seen a lot of content agencies. That's in their terms. That's in their packages now. I see a few online. I talked to a few of them. It's like, this is part of the deal. Take it or leave it, right? And they have enough conviction. We'll move on. So it's a powerful statement, right? But they're so adamant that they will not be effective and they'll deliver you a poor service if they don't have the ability to do that.
Frank noted he did 10,000 surveys a week. I think he's trying to one up your 1,800.
That's wild. Yeah.
A lot of data to dig through.
God bless you, Frank. I would never be able to handle that. But
yeah,
I'm glad you survived. Yeah, nuance is lost. Yeah.
So what's interesting with Frank's statement, though, is, you know, outside of AI, any other trends you see coming up in the industry that are really going to affect market research in the future? Things that you're excited about, or that you see are just going to be interesting in your world?
I mean, I feel like it's early days still for what I do. You know, keep in mind, I've only focused on this work for 2.5 years as a business. I've been doing it my whole career. Mm-hmm. I think like most disciplines, the technology just allows you to move faster. You still need critical thinking and a strategic mindset. And the tools just help with that, right? Same thing. Like, I remember the first time I saw Salesforce when I went back to B2B after being a reporter. I had no idea Salesforce existed. Mm. And then I went back into the business world. I'm like, what is this Salesforce? Where has this been? This is the answer. Problems are all solved. And it's like, but then as you dig into it, you realize, oh no, okay, this just helps with a piece that we didn't have before.
Right.
So I'm just more excited about the fact that people seem to be more interested in qualitative research. LinkedIn is really interesting just to see sort of how it's almost like a real-time conversation, and a spectrum of where people are in their understanding of business and how to build out go-to-market strategies and how to build products and develop them. I feel, and maybe it's a bias of mine because my eyes are always sort of glued to seeing those types of conversations and I'm invested in them. There's a bit more dialogue around trying to understand your customers in a qualitative setting. But there is more tools. The tool I use the most right now is a tool called Dovetail, which is designed specifically for researchers, right? Again, mostly traditionally UI, UX. I'm a marketing researcher and a sales researcher. I see more of those. So I didn't really answer your question directly, Jeff, but I think I'm just more excited about what seems to be more embracement of research in general.
Right.
And that's sort of what I'm excited about.
I want to ask a follow-up here. I'm stealing one of Jeff's questions, but I think it's important. You know, there is this saying that we always throw around, right? It's like, you know, marketing, it's one part art, it's one part science, right? And so these are two sides of the coin. And I'm curious to know, for you, the more you do this work, how much do you feel like you are finding that balance between these data-driven insights that you're gathering and intuition when it comes to making strategic marketing decisions? Because to me, there's also this thing of like, sometimes you just know, right? Sometimes you just have a feeling or an understanding of the market, and it's hard, right? Because then we can't explain these things to clients. And maybe then we're just going out to gather data to back up our hunch, right? But how much of this work do you feel like also has an intuitive element to it that comes out of just really understanding people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't asked that one before. I don't know. I mean, I've always, my
how I've always seen intuition is sort of like, that's just learned experiences over time that sort of bubble up quickly without you almost being cognizant of them. That's, I know that's a great definition, but.
Yeah, I find like as I do more of this work, it actually informs the creative. I'm one of those people who believes that lack of options is a forcing function for creativity. So like a white canvas, you can do anything. But if you have limitations around what you can put on the canvas, you start to think more about how you approach problems. So yeah, no, I find it, the balance still holds true and they sort of inform each other. But I would say, I think the research makes the creative, the art, the science makes the art better. That's what I find. And it's more fun because what I really like, because I am competitive about these things. And when I find when we really start to understand a customer and a buyer and we see it out in the competitive landscape, people doing things we used to do that we know we should not do anymore. I'm like, I did that. Best of luck to you. Right. And then it's like, I'm on the right track. So yeah, I don't know. It's, I like this work so I can be more creative, I guess, is that what I'm saying?
That's great. Well, I'm looking at the time. Ryan, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Hey, this is great.
Thank you. Any projects you're working on that you want to plug, tell us about?
Oh, not really. I mean, I'm always around. Matt and I know each other for years now, and we'll talk on occasion. It's great. We always get to catch up. So I invite anyone. If they just want to reach out on LinkedIn, just reach out. I'm always happy to try and help. I might not have all the answers, but I'll help where I can. And if they want to find me at contentlift.io, LinkedIn, I do have a guide. I don't want to plug anything hard, but I mean, the people are more interested in like my process. It's there. I know I'm doing more and more coaching, I find now, which is interesting. And that's fun. Like it's sort of working side by side in tandem with business owners and entrepreneurs, but how they approach this work. Because everyone gets the value of it that I speak with, because I get high intent people coming in. Yeah. Thanks, Frank. So it's just like, it's fun for me to work with them, and I get jazzed with them getting excited about it. So yeah, please just reach out. I'm always happy to try and help.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Madeline, what are you working on these days? Anything you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm going on vacation, so I'm working on gearing up for that. I haven't done one of those in a while. Jeff got lucky and got to do one a little while back. So I'm working on that today. But in August, I'll make sure in the show notes we plug this more thoroughly. But we're gearing up to do a social media Ask Me Anything. And I've been thinking and writing a lot, especially this past week, about Threads, new social media platform on the scene. And I'm excited. I think that it'll be a really good place and space for these kind of conversations to happen in a different way and to get a pulse of a customer in a different way. And so Alina, who is our head of social media strategy at Fearless Foundry, she's going to be leading kind of an Ask Me Anything style session in August where people can show up and talk about the changes that they're seeing in social media and how they should be taking action in terms of their business. So we'll be doing that next month. What about you, Jeff? Yeah. What you got going on?
Well, nothing new right now. I am excited after this. I'm headed down to Dallas. One of my clients, just shouting them out. They're celebrating 20 years in business. So super excited about that.
Very nice. Congratulations to them.
That is huge. Huge milestone. So that should be fun. Awesome. It should be a lot of fun.
Man, if you can make it 20 years.
Exactly.
That's gold star. That's five gold stars. Yeah.
Exactly. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in. This recording, as many of you know, will be available on LinkedIn as soon as we end, and we'll be live again in 2 more weeks.
You can also tune into last month's episodes on all streaming platforms. And keep an eye out for this month's episodes, which will drop on your favorite streaming platforms the first Friday of next month. And of course, you can always go to creativefriction.com to learn more about the podcast and see anything about past episodes. Thank you so much, Ryan, for being on with us. I hope you all have a fantastic weekend. Take care, everybody.
Bye, guys. You just listened to Creative Friction. Please leave us a rate and review if you enjoyed the show. And if you want to learn more about Fearless Foundry or The Mead Company, go to our website at creativefriction.com.
All audio and video recordings are owned by Madeline Reeves and Jeff Mead and are recorded live every other Friday on LinkedIn and released once a month. Creative Friction is produced by Fina Valenzuela of Fearless Foundry. Music is by Premium Beats.